poetry, I feel, is a tyrannical discipline. You've got to go so far, so fast, in such a small space that you've just got to burn away all the peripherals.
That was Sylvia Plath from 1962, and this is Poetry Off the Shelf from the Poetry Foundation. This week, 50 Years of Ariel.
Does not my heat astound you, and my light?
We don't often think of women speaking out in this way.
Sylvia Plath's book Ariel was published in the United States 50 years ago, in the spring of 1966, 3 years after her death. It had come out in England the year before, and it's been in print ever since.
There are very few truly popular poets, and she's one of them.
Today on the program, we're going to listen to a few poems from Ariel with poet and critic Craig Morgan Teicher.
She really figured out how to make language do a whole bunch of stuff that it didn't otherwise do.
Ariel is a book that I never cease to be amazed by.
Writer Erica Wagner.
Every time I go back to it, I'm shocked by its power.
And poet Dorothea Lasky.
I think there's a kind of fear that you feel to realize just how great she was.
I think I am going up. I think I may rise.
What is going on?
I've been sitting here for 12 hours!
Ariel, the book, is complicated by Sylvia Plath's biography, which is almost too well known. Many books and articles have been written about her troubled marriage to the British poet Ted Hughes and about the meaning of her suicide. And there's even a movie, Sylvia, about Plath and Hughes, starring Gwyneth Paltrow and Daniel Craig. I don't recommend it. There probably would not be such intense interest in her life if her poetry weren't so good. But even so, over the past 50 years, her poems have often taken a backseat to her story. Erica Wagner wrote a biography of Ted Hughes, and so she knows a lot about Plath, and I asked her about this.
I agree with you that that has often either pushed her poetry into the background or made the readings of her poems exclusively biographical.
In distorting the meaning of the poem, can you give me an example of a reading of her poetry that is sort of a distorted reading?
Well, I think what happens is not so much distortions as reductions.
Mm.
She became very interested in mythology, in putting deeper meanings into the personal stories that we tell, or rather seeing those personal stories as part of a larger story. So I think then what happens with a poem like Daddy?
Every woman adores a fascist, the brute in the face, the brute heart of a brute like you.
It becomes either specifically attached to her relationship with her own father, who died when she was a little girl, or her relationship with Ted Hughes.
I made a model of you, a man in black with a Mein Kampf look and a love of the rack and the screw, and I said, I do, I do.
The poem becomes closed down and just attached to her biography.
They always knew it was you. Daddy, daddy, you bastard, I'm through.
And biographical reductions of her poems have gone on for 50 years, often narrowing them to people's and to her psychological issues. Yet some biography is helpful in understanding the phenomenon that is Ariel. Can you tell us about the writing of the book? What was going on in her life when Ariel was written?
Well, when she was writing Ariel, she had really separated from Ted Hughes and was living on her own in North London. It was a very, very difficult time for her. She was struggling to look after her children. She was struggling to find the time to write, but she did find the time to write, usually very early in the morning. She seems to have had a period, really, of extraordinary white-hot composition.
She was having a real kind of seizure of writing activity.
Craig Morgan Teicher says that the Ariel poems were a breakthrough for Plath.
And was aware of it, you know, felt herself to really be lucid in a way that she knew was different than she had been before.
Morning Song,
The first poem in Ariel is about the experience of having a new baby.
It's one of the few poems that's honest about how ambivalent new parents often feel.
And in its time, it was one of the few poems about motherhood from a female point of view.
It's a very good example of an understanding of domestic life, motherhood, love, combined with an austere distance from that life.
Let's listen to Morning Song, stanza by stanza. Plath never recorded this poem. The reader here is Cindy Katz.
Love set you going like a fat gold watch. The midwife slapped your footsoles, and your bald cry took its place among the elements.
Love set you going like a fat gold watch. Da 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 da. And those last three words, fat gold watch, have a sense of ticking, but also have this sense of time accelerating.
Our voices echo, magnifying your arrival. New statue. In a drafty museum, your nakedness shadows our safety.
New statue. So this child is not a baby.
Because this is not quite a person yet. It's a thing.
In a drafty museum.
Your nakedness shadows our safety. And so suddenly she makes the house into this drafty museum. They're out of time, and you're there as a kind of tourist. And then we have this amazing third stanza, which is just one of the best stanzas I can think of. It's, I don't know, when I try to tell somebody what, like, how can you tell what poetry is? This is it.
I'm no more your mother than the cloud that distills a mirror to reflect its own slow effacement at the wind's hand.
Here's a sentence that really doesn't make sense. Like, you really can't paraphrase it, except that it's absolutely accurate and could only be said this way.
I'm no more your mother than the cloud that distills a mirror to reflect its own slow effacement at the wind's hand.
The baby, it's the mirror in which she can see herself dissolve.
One thing that mothers can feel is that your own self is effaced.
She's trying to figure out the extent to which or the way in which she identifies with the baby.
See, to me, I find that very much a sweet moment because then it follows into the mother that's carefully watching the baby breathing and making sure it's not going to die in the crib.
All night, your moth breath flickers among the flat pink roses. I wake to listen. A far sea moves in my ear.
I wake to listen. You know, any parent will know that you've spent time just listening, not to, but for your baby, and then you kind of become interested or enraptured.
One cry and I stumble from bed, cow heavy and floral in my Victorian nightgown. Your mouth opens clean as a cat's.
Cat's mouths are so strange. They are clean, but they smell funny. Again, this is an other, not something she can identify with.
The window square whitens and swallows its dull stars. And now you try your handful of notes. The clear vowels rise like balloons.
That final image of balloons, the notes of the cry drifting away, out of the parent's grasp, out of the grasp of the voice of the poet. You're kind of left as the reader drifting off, I feel, not knowing where to place yourself within this poem.
I don't know, when you let a balloon go into the air, it just goes and goes and goes and it's gone. And I feel like it's such a strange and ambivalent way to exit the poem.
It might not be as sweet to the baby as we want it to be, but it's, you know, it's caring in its own way because that is kind of the feeling. It's very much in awe of the baby and what has just happened. And in that way, it's very reverent.
So that's the first poem in Ariel.
It's also one of the great first poems in a book.
And it leads into a sequence of poems that would ultimately make Plath's reputation. Let's dip into a few of them to give an idea of the depth and breadth of Ariel.
The Applicant.
The Applicant is a satirical poem in the guise of an interview.
First, are you our sort of person?
The Applicant seems to be someone looking for something.
Now your head, excuse me, is empty. I have the ticket for that.
And a wife is what he's going to be given.
Come here, sweetie, out of the closet. Well, what do you think of that? Naked as paper to start, but in 25 years she'll be silver, in 50, gold. A living doll everywhere you look. It can sew, it can cook, it can talk.
The applicant, with its sardonic take on marriage, has become something of a feminist anthem. Let's skip a few pages in Ariel to a poem in a very different register, one of the most shocking things Sylvia Plath ever wrote.
Lady Lazarus.
In the poem, the speaker boasts about coming back to life after attempting suicide.
I have done it again. 1 year in every 10, I manage it. A sort of walking miracle. My skin bright as a Nazi lampshade. My right foot a paperweight. My face a featureless fine Jew linen.
It's performative, is I think fundamentally what it is. She's aware every time she throws something in there that is sort of a no-no that the reader's going to recoil a little bit.
The second time I meant to last it out and not come back at all. I rocked shut as a seashell. They had to call and call and pick the worms off me like sticky pearls. Dying is an art. Like everything else. I do it exceptionally well.
Much has been made over the autobiographical elements in this poem, for good reason. At various points in her life, Sylvia Plath tried to kill herself before finally succeeding. But where is the biography here in this ending?
Hear God, hear Lucifer. Beware, beware. Out of the ash I rise with my red hair, and I eat men like air.
And I eat men like air. That there is the distinctive voice of Ariel, that proud, aggressive, rude, distinctly female voice that animates so many of the poems. But what is that voice?
Oracular. The voice of Ariel is one of a seer who has a kind of planetary distance.
I'm trying not to say what might be considered sort of typical cliches about her work, but it is a voice. I think all good poetry, great poetry, all poetry that's going to last is a voice that's kind of beyond the grave. You know, it's a voice with the kind of knowledge of someone that's sort of gone back and come back and maybe, you know, lived several lives and is here to sort of put that in language.
Where did the voice come from? I think that's one of the most remarkable things about it. It really seemed to come from herself. When you say it's rude, when you say it's aggressive, I think one of the things that's interesting is we don't often think of women speaking out in this way. What is striking is if you then talk to or read the generation, particularly of women poets who came after her, they will say that they felt very freed by reading this voice.
It did give me this sort of empowerment, because I think that a lot of people make a big deal about the dark emotions in her work, but the biggest thing that I've always felt is that she does find a place for emotions, really, really, really intense emotions that one is going to harness and make into a very precise light. That empowered me that I could do that too.
Now let's go deeply again into another poem from the book, one of her most famous, and one that seems to fully embody the shocking and outrageous and otherworldly voice of Ariel.
Fever 103.
Fever 103 is a poem about literally having a fever as a kind of access to unfettered power.
It's a fever dream.
I mean, the fever makes her both extremely in her body and extremely out of her body. So then she just narrates the process.
I think that this poem is very much about hell.
She does the whole Divine Comedy in one little poem.
Fever 103.
Pure, what does it mean? The tongues of hell are dull. Dull as the triple tongues of dull fat Cerberus who wheezes at the gate. Incapable of licking clean the ague tendon, the sin, the sin.
Cerberus there is a hound in Greek and Roman mythology who guards the gates of hell.
I love the way that she's able to use classical mythology and I think make it consistently fresh.
The tinder cries. The indelible smell of a snuffed candle.
She's in part sort of simulating for us, without quite telling us what's going on, what it's like to have a fever.
Love, love, the low smokes roll from me like Isadora's scarves. I'm in a fright one scarf will catch an anchor in the wheel.
She's able to put in details and references in this very, very not snotty way.
The reference there was to the great modernist dancer Isadora Duncan.
Yeah, Isadora Duncan wore really long, beautiful scarves and one caught in a car's wheel, and she died.
And then the poem returns to the low smokes rolling from her body.
Such yellow, sullen smokes make their own element. They will not rise.
She loves rising here throughout these poems. Rise is one of those words for her.
But trundle round the globe, choking the aged and the meek, the weak hothouse baby in its crib, the ghastly orchid hanging its hanging garden in the air. Devilish leopard.
She likes also cats and plants that become cats.
And that sudden switch into the devilish leopard after we've had Isadora and the scarves and the smokes, that's a complete transformation. Again, the way that you have hallucinations in a fever.
I really love that hothouse baby. We're talking about her sort of twisting and turning our expectations of the maternal, but I love that, like, even the baby is not safe of burning in hell.
Radiation turned it white and killed it in an hour. Greasing the bodies of adulterers like Hiroshima ash and eating in the sin, the sin.
So again, she's in hell and she's pulling in World War II stuff that is just really not fair. And, you know, her situation is not commensurate to her metaphor, but that's part of her plan.
Darling, all night I have been flickering, off, on, off, on. The sheets grow heavy as a lecher's kiss.
She's talking to someone who has done her wrong. But yet that she's talking to that person, that you, with such an overwhelming desire. And that idea of flickering off, on, off, on, we think of like a light like in a brothel, like a busted out red light or something that's going, you know, off, on, off, on. I'm in here, I'm available.
3 days, 3 nights. Lemon water, chicken water, water make me rich. I am too pure for you or anyone. Your body hurts me as the world hurts God.
In a literal sense, when you're sick, you just don't want anyone to touch you. It feels gross. But she's trying to find a way to make that meaningful and to make it a kind of access way to transcendent power.
I am a lantern. My head a moon of Japanese paper, my gold-beaten skin infinitely delicate and infinitely expensive. Does not my heat astound you, and my light?
So this is where the poem gets really interesting to me. Does not my heat astound you? What an odd thing to say. Because, of course, the heat doesn't astound us. It concerns us. It means she's sick. It's a self-aggrandizement, but it's a knowing one.
All by myself, I am a huge camellia, glowing and coming and going, flush on flush. I think I am going up. I think I may rise.
There's that word again.
The beads of hot metal fly, and I, love, I am a pure acetylene virgin, attended by roses, by kisses, by cherubim, by whatever these pink things mean.
You know, I really see that as this kind of idea of melting flesh, that a person has been completely consumed by a fever, both erotically, spiritually, and then actually physically, the eye is being completely, you know, burned to the core.
Not you, nor him, nor him, nor him. Myself dissolving old whore petticoats to paradise.
Where do those old whore petticoats come from? They come from nowhere, and that's what makes them so spectacular.
Really, one of the subjects of the work is if a person can't transcend their circumstance bodily, then can they transcend it in some other way, in language?
Sylvia Plath had faith that as poets, that's all we can hope for, is that the eye can get free of whatever has trapped it in this lifetime. And you have a sense, one has a sense, I have a sense that she knows that she's created a kind of immortal eye that has gone past whatever the stuff was that was sort of miring it in its everyday existence, and it's like a timeless eye. Knowing that is what kind of gives it its power. The eye knows that it has succeeded, and I think it really has by that point of the poem.
I think I am going up. I think I may rise. The beads of hot metal fly, and I love. I am a pure acetylene virgin, attended by roses, by kisses, by cherubim, by whatever these pink things mean. Not you, nor him, nor him, nor him, myself dissolving, old whore petticoats, to paradise.
That's Cindy Katz with that reading. The commentators were Craig Morgan Teicher, Erica Wagner, and Dorothea Lasky. You could read poems by Sylvia Plath on our website. There's also a new restored version of Ariel with a foreword by Sylvia Plath's daughter Frida out from Harper Perennial. Let us know what you think of this podcast. Email us at podcast@poetryfoundation.org. All the music in this program comes from the Claudia Quintet. For Poetry Off the Shelf, I'm Curtis Fox. Thanks for listening.